We're holding Shmuel Beis, and we had finished the 15th chapter. We'll quickly recount what we saw. We had seen that Avshalom had murdered his brother Amnon. Amnon was the eldest son that David HaMelech had. The next in line to inherit the throne is Avshalom, after he's killed his brother Amnon. And we discussed the whole history that led up to Avshalom's killing of Amnon. We discussed that after Avshalom killed Amnon, he fled to his grandfather, to the king of Geshur. And upon 2 years passing, Yoav recognizes that David really wants him back. And Yoav sends a wise woman from Tekoa to give this whole story before the king. And finally he convinces the king to bring Avshalom back. And when Avshalom is returned, the king says, send him home, I don't want to see him. And after 2 years pass like this, so Avshalom sends word to Yoav, come see me. And Yoav refuses. And finally Avshalom burns Yoav's grain. And then Yoav comes storming in. And Avshalom tells him, what'd you bring me back for if this is the treatment I'm getting? And Yoav takes his case to the king. And finally the king agrees to see him, but he doesn't treat him the way he would treat a son that's going to take the throne after his death. And Avshalom recognizes that David HaMelech does not plan on giving him the throne. David HaMelech has received in prophecy that Shlomo is going to be king. David HaMelech has promised Bathsheba that her next son, which was in fact Shlomo, would be king. And David HaMelech has no intention of giving the throne to Avshalom. Now Avshalom is exceptionally handsome. He was a Nazir Olam, and he shaved his head once a year. And he had such beautiful locks when the year was up that he was able to sell them for a large amount of money. And these good looks got Avshalom thinking that he's really fit to be a leader. Good looks very often cause people to have a weakness, to have pride. The Gemara records that one rabbi said, because of my bad looks, that's why I've gotten this far. And another rabbi asked him, but I'm good looking and look how far I got. So he answered him, he said, yeah, and if you'd be bad looking, you'd have gotten even further. This is as far as you got with your good looks. But if you wouldn't have those inhibitions, you could have continued. So Avshalom also knows that genealogically he's the next in line. He's the oldest son that's left alive. And in these 2 years that passed, while David refused to see him, Avshalom bore three sons, all of which died, all of which passed away. And this was, our sages told us that if someone burns his friend's grain, then he won't leave behind an inheritor. And that's in fact what happened. So Avshalom now is in position where his thoughts are, yeah.
Did they teach because of what happened, or did they already have that teaching and then he transgressed it and that's what happened?
I think the Gemara says Gemiri, that we have on tradition. Now whether this tradition preceded Avshalom or not, the Gemara brings this as a support. I don't know if this is the source. I don't know. So Avshalom, his thoughts are the following. I'm the next in line. I'm the eldest. I'm good looking. And that does have a certain weight. When it came time to choose the Rosh Yeshiva for Velazhen, so there were great rabbis. And the Netziv was chosen because he had the air of aristocracy. And that does have a certain weight. In order for a person to lead, he not only has to be fit with all the traits and with all the Torah, he also has to have a certain air of leadership to him, and Avshalom feels like he has it. He's supposedly close to God. He's a Nazir. He shaves his head only once a year. And another thing that's driving Avshalom is the fact that he has no heir. He's lost all his children. And if he attains the throne, then he'll have a remembrance. And if he just dies without children, so that's it. It's over. So when people would come to be judged before King David, he'd wake up early in the morning and he'd be out there like a good politician and he'd meet the people and he'd ask them, where are you from? You notice when someone asks you, where are you from? He's indicating, I'm interested in you. I care about you. What city are you from? And that was the first act of theft which Avshalom did, misleading the Jewish people, showing that he cared for them. And he was also trying to stir up resentment among the other tribes against King David, because he would say, "Where are you from?" And then he'd say, "Oh, the king's not going to listen to you." And he was indicating that you're not from David's tribe, you're not from the tribe of Yehuda, you don't stand the chance before him. And in just making this inference, he was causing the people to feel like they were getting misjudged. And we discussed last week that most people walk out of court and they're unhappy with the final ruling. He'd tell the people, you know, the king's not listening to you. He doesn't hear you well enough. If only I would judge the Jewish people. And here he's making a subtle reference to the fact that he wants to be king, but he's also making a subtle reference to his good, quote-unquote, traits. He's saying, I don't want to rule over you. I'm not looking to take the pride and honor of a king. I just want the responsibilities of a king. If I were king, I would judge correctly. That's one of the responsibilities of a king. And he's indicating that if he were only king, he would take that responsibility well. And when the person would bow before him, then Avshalom would make like he was an exceptionally modest person and hold him back and kiss him like we're comrades, we're equals. And then he stole David's heart. He took 200 of David's best friends, David's top people, David's most faithful people, with him, unbeknownst to them, unbeknownst to David, that he is conspiring to rebel. He took them with him to Hebron. And in doing that, he ensures that David doesn't have his top men surrounding him. And David is going to have to ask himself, are these men with Avshalom or not? David doesn't know who's on his side and who isn't. David doesn't know. So we're nearing the end of David's reign. This is 37, 38 years into David's reign. He has two more years to live. He's an old man. He's 67, 68 years old. And Avshalom purposely takes the men to Hebron. That's where David was anointed. And he's hoping that in doing that, he's going to be able to pull along part of the tribe of Judah with him, part of the tribe of Yehuda. And he sends Achitophel, who was David's chief advisor, he sends him away from his home. So that when David's going to need counsel, what do I do now? He's going to want to think with someone. His top advisor isn't around to think with. Achitophel isn't around. And Achitophel doesn't need any convincing. Achitophel has it in for David ever since David took his granddaughter Bathsheba, and ever since David did what he did with her former husband, her deceased husband. So Achitophel is quick to join Avshalom's side. And when they blow the horn, he has his spies throughout the land. He has people waiting to hear that horn. And they proclaim Avshalom is king. And David gets word that the majority of Israel is following Avshalom. And David has no way of gauging what's going on. He doesn't know who's on his side and who isn't. So David tells his servant, we have to get out of here, because if we stick around here, the first thing that Avshalom is going to do is come and wipe out the city. And he'll be able to say that we wiped out the city. And who's going to know? Who's going to know if we killed the city of Jerusalem or not? He'll easily be able to kill out everyone here and claim that we did it because I was scared that everyone was conspiring against me. I don't need that. We don't want a situation where the city gets wiped out. We have to leave. And David's servants tell him, we're with you. And we discussed last week that David was in a position where he wasn't sure if anyone would join him. Everyone got word that the majority of the Jewish people are with Avshalom. And he doesn't know if he's all alone or not. We have on tradition that at this point, David lost his Ruach HaKodesh. So now David wants to turn to God, and he's not on the level he was. We have another tradition that Parchat Zarat, that David HaMelech got Tzaras at this point. So now no one could come close to him. And God is afflicting him physically, not only with the rebellion of the Jewish people, not only with the fact that God has left him, but he himself now is some form of leper. Yeah. It was part of the punishment that he was supposed to have. That was part of the punishment he was supposed to have for the whole story of Uriah. God asked him, do you want evil to stem from within your home? Do you want to be chased by enemies? What do you want should happen? And David, I'm confusing two different things. That was part of the decree that evil would grow from within David's home. And now David leaves the city and the people have joined him. And his servants are with him. The Kohen Gadol is with him. Eviasar, who was the high priest. And there were people, Philistines, 600 soldiers who had switched sides. Ittai Hakiti, together with another 600 men, had just joined David's forces. And now they've just come. They're after a long journey. They come and they cross over. And David tells Ittai, he tells him, "What are you coming for? Go sit in the city. You're a Gentile. You're not Jewish. You just got here. You're a stranger. Sit in Jerusalem. What do you need this for? And you've done more than enough for me." And Ittai tells him, "I'm with you for death or for life. I'm with you." David tells him, "You have nothing to fear. If Avshalom doesn't like you, worst comes to worst, you go back home. You go back to Gath, to the Philistine cities. If he's willing to let you sit in peace in Jerusalem, so sit in peace in Jerusalem. What do you have to come with me for?" And Ittai says, "No. Friendship is about being with a person in the toughest times. I'm with you for life or death. I'm with you." And he takes his 600 men and they continue with David. Everyone's crying and the king is alone. He has tzaras. No one can come close to him. And Tzadok and the Levim come with him carrying the Aron. And they set up the Aron. And Eviyasar goes up before the Aron. After everyone's passed, along comes the Kohen Gadol and the Levim with the Aron. And David tells Tzadok, "Bring the Aron back to the city. If I find favor in God's eyes, he'll bring me back. He'll show me his beauty, his home, his castle. And if God says he doesn't want me, so here I am, let him do what he sees fit." Now, the question here is, the psukim switched. You notice we were discussing Eviyasar leading the show, Eviyasar being the high priest, and then the king speaks to Tzadok and tells him, "Go back home." So our sages say that what happened here was not the way we just read it, that this conversation has to be read differently. We have a tradition that Eviyasar was asked to ask God, "What should we do now? Am I going to make it back in peace or not?" David asked God. And God didn't answer. And at this point, David was uncertain, is the lack of response due to a fault within him? Is it due to the fact that God is so upset with him that he's not getting an answer? Or is there something wrong with Eviyasar? And David said, "Let's try a different Kohen Gadol. Let's try Tzadok." Now, if we go back a few years, in the time of Shmuel, if you recall, the Kohen Gadol was Eli. And Eli's children had transgressed, and they had sinned and caused the Chilul Hashem, and Eli hadn't responded harshly enough. And the decree came from God that God would remove the Kohuna Gadol of the high priesthood from Eli's family and give it over to another family. And we have on tradition that this is when it happened. When David was leaving the city of Jerusalem and he asked Eviyasar, who was Eli's grandson, ask God whether I'm going to make it back or not, and God wouldn't answer. So David said, "Okay, Tzadok, you try." And Tzadok put on the clothing of the Kohen Gadol and God responded. And at that point, Tzadok became the Kohen Gadol and Eviyasar was removed from the post. And this is the time when the Kohuna Gadolah was removed from Eli's family. If you think about it, it takes a lot of courage. David sees everything's turning against him. In one second, the Jewish people have turned against him. The Shechina has left him. He's gotten tzaras. And we have on tradition that at this point, David said, "Let me go serve idols." And he was going up the mountain and he said, "If God doesn't want me, so at least there won't be a Chilul Hashem. They'll say I was an idol worshiper. People won't say I was such a pious person and God didn't like me anyways." So he was going up the mountain to serve idols. And along comes Ira HaYairi, his Rebbe. And Ira says, "David, where are you headed?" And David says, "I'm going to go serve idols." And Ira says, "David, what's going on?" And David says, "You tell me. Look at what I've done. Look at what God's done to me." And Ira says, "Did anyone ever tell you to marry Avshalom's mother? By what right did you marry Macha, Avshalom's mother? You were out of war, there was a beautiful woman, and you took her as your wife. And look, this is the son that came from such a communion." So David says, "What do you mean? The Torah permits it. The Torah says that when one is at war, if he sees a beautiful woman, and he's winning the war, he may take her, and ultimately take her as his wife if she agrees. So I took her." So Ira says, "Yeah, the Torah permits it. The Torah doesn't recommend it. The Torah says if you take such a wife, then she's never going to really love you. She's never going to join the Jewish faith because she never wanted it. You took her by force. Yeah, she lost her family. Everyone's been lost to war and now she has no choice. So you ask her, do you want it? She'll say yes. But is she going to be a good Jewish mother? No. And that's why the Torah puts the juxtaposition of two parashios. Right after the Torah tells us, you may take her at war, the Torah says you may have two children, one from a wife that you love, one from a wife that you hate. The Torah is alluding to the fact that you won't ultimately love her. This isn't the way to find a good shidduch. And then the Torah says, if you have a son that's rebellious, and you see that he's going in murderous ways, how you take him to court and you try to take care of him. The Torah is alluding to the fact that if you take a wife like this, then you're not going to have a good marriage, and the chinuch isn't going to be good, and you'll end up having a son like you, David, had. So David, you brought this upon yourself. What are you angry at God for? Who asked you to take his mother as a wife? And after Ira tells him this, David backs off. David, our sages say that great people needed great people to help them. There was no such thing as a person who was able to make it on his own. Everyone had their low point in life, and everyone needed their Rebbe to stand there and pull them up. And the Medrash goes one by one showing us how the great people in our history all had their low points. And they were fortunate to have their Rebbe standing at their side to show up and say, hey, you're wrong, hold it, and pull them back. Shlomo, only after Shlomo, David's son, the next king, King Solomon, only after his Rebbe is put to death, only then does Shlomo sin with the daughter of Pharaoh. Only then does his kingdom go down. The greatest people needed to have a Rebbe, and it was to their benefit. David HaMelech was on his way down, and to his good fortune, Ira Ya'iri comes to meet him and says, David, hold it. You brought this upon yourself. Take it easy.
From which nation came Absalom's mother? Came from? Which
nation? From Geshur.
Geshur? Is it in the north?
If I'm not mistaken, yeah. I have to look. I don't remember. If I'm not mistaken, yes.
Another question. Could be that the Philistines, the 600 Philistines, joined David because they were frightened they will lose some financial or other interest if the troglodyte Absalom is going to win the kingship, and they are out of the tribal circle, and they will lose.
I think in situations like this, no one knows what's going to be when the dust settles. And right now, it looked like Absalom had the upper hand. That's what it looked like. You see, David's on the run. Doesn't seem like David has the upper hand at this point. And it is unclear among the commentaries whether Avshalom's intent was to murder his father or Avshalom's intent was to take the throne in David's lifetime. Avshalom sensed that David is not going to give him the throne. And Avshalom said, if I give it a little bit longer, David will make Shlomo king within his lifetime, which David did. A short while later, David takes Shlomo and appoints him as king within his lifetime. And that's as a reaction to the next rebellion. His next son, Adoniah, is going to try to take the throne. And then David is going to say, enough is enough, I'm anointing Shlomo right now within my lifetime. It's going to be clear to everyone that he's king. But Avshalom senses that this is coming. He doesn't know exactly which son David is going to choose, but he knows it's not him. So Avshalom jumps to the gun, and it's unclear among the commentaries whether Avshalom's intent was to kill his father or not. So no one knew where the dust would settle, and at this point, the political map seemed like it would be most advantageous to join Avshalom's camp. It didn't seem like David was going to win. David himself is doubtful. He says, I don't know if I'm going to win. Why should I take Daron with me? God doesn't have to be exiled just because I'm exiled. I'm exiled. Daron remains in its place, which is another sign of David's greatness.
Was it, as I understand, as I read the Shmuel, that the Philistines are almost, David has very good relationship with the Philistines, and they were the most faithful to him from all the tribes. Is it true? From all the people living in the Eretz Israel.
I don't know. The Plishtim were a constant threat. David HaMelech, possibly one of his great military accomplishments is that he was able to make the Philistines subservient to the Jewish Empire. Until David HaMelech's time, even throughout King Saul's kingdom, we have constant battles with him. And although we maintain our king, they never overtake us like they had until now. Once King Saul's anointed, we maintain a kingdom. We do maintain that much sovereignty, but they do keep attacking us. And they remain a constant threat until David HaMelech's time. David HaMelech is the one that's able to quiet them down.
Was it because he was a comrade of them?
I don't think so. No, he fought them. He fought them at war. He fought them a lot. He fought them even before he was king.
But later on, they served together for a while.
I don't know what you're referring to. Show me. Yeah?
When Saul was the king, Saul was persecuting him, he went to the Philistine king.
There was a time when he took refuge in the Philistine camp, but that later on he fought them again. So David tells Tzadok, go back to the city. You have your son Achimatz, Evyosar's son, Yehonah's son, your two sons are with you. I'm going to detain myself in the desert and I'm waiting for word from you what's going on. And David goes up by Ma'aleh HaZeitim and he's crying. He's walking without a hat, without his crown. He's walking barefoot because he feels like he's in nidui. He feels like God has ostracized him. He has tzaras. So he's walking like a metzora. A metzora has to act like an avel. And everyone's going together with their heads uncovered, going and crying. And David was told that Achitophel was in on the plot, and Achitophel is one of those that have joined Avshalom in the rebellion. And David lets up a prayer. He says, God, please falter, please undo the advice of Achitophel. Please ruin his advice. It's interesting that we don't find many specific prayers. The chapters in Tehillim do discuss David's prayers when Avshalom rebelled, but specifically we see that in Shmuel, what's represented is only this prayer. Please undo Achitophel's advice. And I've often thought that this goes back to the pasuk Utshua berov yoetz. Salvation comes when you have a lot of good advice. It's not enough to have a good army. You have to know what you're doing. There was once a caricature, a cartoon, that showed the Israeli state on top. And you have all the F-16s and F-15s and tanks and all the greatest artillery and all the greatest technology. And on the bottom beneath, you see an Arab standing with his chisel. And you see the state of Israel on top going down like an upside-down pyramid. And he's hacking away at the bottom of the pyramid, so the whole thing's going to collapse. So he's only working with his chisel, but he's on bottom. He's got he's seeing something we don't see. In my own prayers, I've often incorporated this. That David HaMelech prays, please ruin the advice of the enemy. That seems to be at the root of their success, as if they're going to have good advice. So David comes, and Hushai Ha'arki comes towards him. And David tells him, if you're going to join me, so you're going to weigh me down. What I need you to do is go back to the city and act as Avshalom's advisor. Make believe you're on his side and try to undo Achitophel's advice. That's the best assistance you could give me. I don't need you among my men. You have Tzadok and Evyosar, the Kohanim are there. When you hear word, you send word and they'll send it with their son. And Hushai comes to the city and Avshalom comes to the city. And David is on the outskirts, out in the desert, waiting to hear word what to do. As David's going, he's going without cattle, without his mule, without his horse, without his donkey, without food. And along comes Tziva. Now this is a pivotal moment in David's life. God tests us when our nerves are taut, when things are tough. That's when God's looking at us. How are we going to react? And David is going to fail this test and succeed the next test. He sees Tziva. Now if you recall, Tziva was the servant who had run King Saul's home. And when King Saul had died and all his children had died at battle, David had called in Yonasan's son. If you recall, Yonasan was his close friend, his brother-in-law, right? David married King Saul's daughter, so Yonasan was his brother-in-law. And David had promised Yonasan, I'm going to take care of your children. Even though your father tried to kill me, I will take care of your family. And David HaMelech found out that Yonasan had one son left over, Mephibosheth, who was a great Talmid Chacham, but he was a cripple, he couldn't walk. And David HaMelech brought him and he said, you always eat at my table. And David took all of King Saul's land and property and gave it to Mephibosheth. And he told Tziva, this top servant, you put together all of King Saul's assets, and you have to be a faithful servant to Mephibosheth. And now Tziva is coming along with a pair of donkeys, laden with 200 loaves of bread, 100 dry grapes, raisins, 100 dry figs, flasks of wine. And the king asks him, what's all this? And Tziva says, I'm bringing you donkeys to ride on, and I brought you bread, and I brought you food and wine, everything. You're all out in the desert, you're all tired. And David says, and where is your master's son? Where's Mephibosheth? So Tziva says, he's waiting in Jerusalem, and he's hoping that when the dust settles, he'll end up taking the throne. He's saying, today there's internal conflict in King David's home. When the dust settles, I'm going to take the throne. I'm going to get the throne back. David's hearing Lashon Hara. Tziva is telling him a story. He has no way of validating the story. He has no way of verifying the story. And at this point, David's at a low point in his life. He's on the verge of death. The Jewish people have turned against him again. And in spite of that, David HaMelech gives ruling, and he says, everything Mephibosheth owns, I'm giving to you. I hereby decree, you're going to get everything Mephibosheth owns, and he bows before Tziva. David HaMelech continues his journey, and another one from King Saul's family comes out, and this is the head of the Jewish court, Shimi ben Gera. Shimi ben Gera is the chief rabbi, and he was a big, big sage, big Talmud Chacham, but he's from King Saul's family. And as David's walking, he starts picking up rocks and throwing rocks and dirt at David and all his servants. And Shimi starts cursing him, and he says, "Tzei, tzei, get out of here. Get out of here, Isha damim ve'isha belial. You man whose hands are dirtied with blood. You lowlife, you unfit, you're not God-fearing person. God has returned upon you the bloods of the house of Shaul that you took the throne in his stead, and God has given the throne in the hands of Absalom your son, and you are now in this terrible state because you are a blood filthy person." It's a pretty bad situation. David HaMelech doesn't feel too hot right now. He's out in the desert, and here's his enemy, a person who he admired until now, the head of the Jewish court, is cursing him. And David's nephews, Avishai, his nephew, Yoav's brother, the son of his sister, Tzruya, tells him, "Why should this dead dog curse you, my master, the king? Let me just cross over there and remove his head." David could say yes, David could say no. David says, "What is it with you, me and you, you sons of my sister, Tzruya? Let him curse. Because if he's cursing, God must have told him to curse me. He's a God-fearing person. He didn't do this on his own. And who knows? Who knows if God told him to do this? Who can claim it, say to him, what are you doing this for?" Yeah?
I just wanted to take a step back. You said that he failed the previous test where he gave all his property to his servant?
Right.
How did he fail that?
He failed because he accepted Lashon Hara. He had no right to give halachic ruling based upon Tziva's Lashon Hara. The true story, what happened was, Mephibosheth called Tziva and said, "We have to arrange everything, we have to go help David. Prepare all the food and we're bringing it to David." Tziva prepared all the food. Mephibosheth was a cripple, he couldn't move. Tziva grabbed the donkeys and said, "This is my chance to get in." Tziva grabbed the food and ran to David. Tziva made up the story. The truth is that Mephibosheth told him, "Put everything together, we got to go help David. David's in trouble, we got to go help." And Tziva made up the story saying, "No, my master is waiting for you to lose the throne." And when David returns to the throne, he's going to see Mephibosheth approaching, and his hair is long, and he hasn't showered. He's been in mourning and prayer over David. And David sees all of this, and in light of what Tziva told him, he immediately interprets it badly. He says, "He must be mourning my return." And so David calls out to Mephibosheth, and he says, "Where were you?" And Mephibosheth says, "My servant deceived me. I was planning on coming, I asked him to prepare everything, and I'm a cripple, and he grabbed everything and he ran first. So my servant deceived me." And David says, "Don't bother me anymore. We're going to divide all of your assets between you and Tziva." And the minute David says that, that's going to be at the end of the story. After David returns to his throne, a heavenly voice comes out and says, "Oh yeah? You said, Amalti atav etziva tachliku. You said you and Tziva, Mephibosheth and Tziva will divide the assets. I say that Yeravam and Rechavam will divide the throne." And at that point in heavens, it was decreed that the Davidic dynasty would no longer rule over all of Israel for this injustice. Now, David is held accountable. David's held to a pretty high standard. I mean, he's at the lowest point of his life. His own son is trying to kill him. All of the Jewish people have gathered up against him. And yet, in heavens, they hold him accountable for not giving proper ruling.
Well, I wanted to say that Shimi ben Gera is mainly doing a really good provocation when he says your hands are filthy of blood. And so, if logically, Shimi ben Gera should be put to death, but then it would be all clear to all the tribes of Israel, to other Israelites, that King David is really a bloodthirsty person, and he's just killing. It is just such a provocative act that there is no way out. Only but King David thought that I will let him to do whatever he wants.
So let's see what Chazal tells about this story. David is king, and Shimi ben Gera is cursing him like this. Now, halachically, it is unclear what David's status is at this minute, because part of having the halachic status of king is that the Jewish people have to accept you. The majority of the Jewish people haven't accepted him. Does he have the status of king enough that someone who curses him deserves to be put to death? That's question number one, which we'll leave on the table. And question number two is, can he kill him? He doesn't know. Maybe Shimi ben Gera is doing this with prophecy. He's a God-fearing person. If Shimi is doing this, we have to check out, verify where it's coming from. Now, David's first instinct probably was, kill him. And David could have killed him. David had the military might. He has one of his top generals is saying, let me go over there and take off his head. Imagine David would have done that. Our sages tell us that when we open the Megillah and we read in Megillah's Esther, a few hundred years later, Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan habira. There was a Jewish man in Shushan, the city of Shushan. Ushmo Mordechai. His name is Mordechai. Ben Yair, Ben Shim'i. Our sages say that Shim'i is his great-great-great-grandfather. That's this. Shimi ben Gera. And Shimi ben Gera has not yet had the offspring that would give forth Mordechai. If David would have killed Shimi at this juncture, Mordechai wouldn't have been born. The whole story of Purim wouldn't have happened, and it is questionable whether the Jewish people would have survived the Persian Empire. There was a decree to kill all of the Jewish people in the Persian Empire. The whole success of the story of Purim rests on this moment, when David can contain himself and say, no, I will not kill him. I cannot verify this. I don't know what's happening here. I will not kill Shimi. And by David's relinquishing the Midas Adin at this point, saying, wait, we're not going to kill him, David gave potential for Mordechai to be born and ultimately the whole story of Esther to come out. Yeah?
When David dies and he gives over the throne to Shlomo, he tells him several things, and he also tells him to punish Shimi.
So we'll have to deal with that.
Commentators say he didn't do it himself to punish him, because he feared that it would be only out of personal revenge. It would be maybe not halachically correct, and Shlomo was not involved in this thing, so he could give a fair judgment.
Top, yafet. So that we'll deal with soon. So
at that time, Shimi had a offspring.
David tells his servants, he says, if my own son, who came from me, wants me dead, how could we blame this one who's from the tribe of Benjamin? So leave him alone, let him curse, because God must have told him to curse. Maybe God will see my tears and give me good in a place for his curse. We have a tradition that if someone curses, if someone says Lashon Hara, if someone does bad to someone else, in heaven they take a whack of his good deeds and they pass it over to his portion. We have a tradition that when we're going to come to heaven, we're going to see many good deeds and we're going to say, I didn't do that. And in heavens they're going to say, right, but so-and-so cursed you, so-and-so spoke badly about you, so-and-so insulted you. When he did that, so we took from his good deeds and put him in your slot. And then we're going to come to heaven and say, but wait, there are some really good things I did. Where are they? And they're going to tell us, well, you once upon a time spoke badly about so-and-so. So at that moment, we switched it over to his portion. So that's something to think about. So David HaMelech says, maybe God will see my tears and give me back good in place of his curse today. And they keep going and they're waiting there. And as they're going, Shimei continues his ways, cursing and throwing earth and stones. Everyone's tired and they're resting, and Avshalom comes to the city. And when Hushai approaches him, he approaches him, lauding him, long live the king, long live the king. And Avshalom tells him, this is the kindness you do to your friend. Why didn't you go with your friend? Notice, Avshalom's taking great care not to call David the king. He's calling him your friend, belittling David. And Hushai tells Avshalom, no, if God chose you and the nation chose you, shouldn't I be with you? Shouldn't I stay with you? And who else can I help who else can I serve if not his son? So I was faithful to your father, so too I will be before you. Avshalom tells Achitophel, I want you to decide what the proper plan is. And Achitophel tells Avshalom, the first thing you have to do is convince people you won't make up with your father. Everyone's wondering, will this rebellion hold? Everyone knows your father, your son, he's a father. So the first thing you have to do is take your father's tent, Pilagshim, take him up to the rooftop, and everyone will see that you've done an action that there's no turning back. Because if David retakes the throne, we'll have to judge you for death. So the only way you can do this is if you're intent on killing him. And Avshalom listens to his advice. And Chazal tells that Achitophel's advice was so good, it was as though you would ask God what was the best advice at this moment. So when Achitophel gives him this advice, it's unclear, was Achitophel interested in Avshalom's good or his own good? What was Achitophel thinking? One understanding says Achitophel was thinking what he said. This will get people to align with you. And it worked. The other understanding says that Achitophel said, let him do it, and then we'll win David, and after we win David, I'll take him to court for doing a biblical prohibition and put him to death, and I'll take the throne. That Achitophel really was thinking to take the throne from Avshalom after Avshalom would do this. Achitophel tells Avshalom, let me take 12,000 men and chase David tonight, and I'll be able to attack him tonight. He's not ready to fight any battle. We'll wipe him out, everyone will run, I'll kill him alone, his men aren't going to be able to stand to battle, and then everyone will unite under you. Achitophel gives him the best possible advice. David is wiped out. He wasn't prepared for war. If Achitophel would have done this, it would have been all over. Achitophel would have won. Avshalom would have won. And Avshalom says that's a good idea. And Avshalom says, let's hear what Hushai has to say. Now Hushai has the task to undo Achitophel's plot. Because Hushai knows full well that David is waiting, not far away, waiting to hear word from them what's going to be. And if they do go, David isn't ready for war. David didn't even take his horses with him. The wealthy people had joined David, and in their haste, no one brought food. That's why they're relying on Tziva, who suddenly shows up, the servant, with the food. David cannot stand up to war at this point. And where we'll pick up next week is with Hushai working to undo Achitophel's advice. So, now,